Welcome back. This is fantastic. Welcome back to another episode of Elite Medical School. We're so excited to join you folks today for a wholesome discussion on sexually transmitted illness infection. So this should be a high yield discussion. A lot of stigma associated with SEI, STDs, used interchangeably. And that's why bringing a little bit of levity to this situation, I think, is helpful. I think this is part of the cure, right? So we can just sort of jump right in. We can just start plowing away, no pun intended.
All right, let's get into it. Let's talk a little bit about epidemiology, high incidence rates worldwide, especially some of our more common presentations. So we have chlamydia, which is probably the most common one you'll encounter in everyday clinical practice. Gonorrhea would be the second most common. And we'll also be watching out for things like HPV, genital herpes, some less common infections. We want to think about syphilis, HIV, hepatitis B, and trichomoniasis.
Crabs,
yep. Pinworms. Well,
that's more of an animal than an infection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a mite. But if you're rubbing the nasty parts together, I suppose you could transmit it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's a good outline of some of the more common ones. So crabs, also known as pubic lice. But in fact, scabies is probably more commonly transmitted. Scabies is not uncommon, especially among low SES. And they can colonize the pubes. So there you go. So yeah, so speaking of sort of risk factors, I had just mentioned low SES being a non-heterosexual, that is MSM, FSM, any sexual minority group, sexually active youth who are under the age of 25, especially for chlamydia and gonorrhea. So a very high risk group. And in fact, it's one of there is evidence to offer for any sexually active youth under the age of 25, at least in our local guidelines, annual screening for STI. Which is sort of interesting. It's straightforward, formally, and we'll get into it. There was an aggressive sort of violating swab. Now it's just a pee test. What else? People that don't use barrier contraception, that's going to be high risk. IV drug use, and then, of course, sex workers. So those are some important risk factors. Yeah. Also, among the MGTOW community, there's a higher prevalence of chlamydia, so be considerate of that population too.
And some easy answers that you can throw into an exam are very obvious things like sexual contact with a person with a known STI or having a previous STI. Those are just easy points you can throw in. Some other risk factors might be if you're a Chad or Stacy, my ex-girlfriend, maybe even a little bit of swinging could be a bit of a risk factor.
If you're also not... being uncircumcised as well.
Yes. Yeah. Being uncircumcised.
And so in terms of patient presentation, we have a gentleman like Dr. C. He comes to your clinic. He's disheveled. He has poor grooming. He's pansexual. He's a sex worker. He has a history of IV drug use. Yeah, he's definitely, yeah. He's had multiple partners within the gooning community in the past year. So what symptoms might he present with? Well, this time he comes in, as usual, complaining about general rash. He says, hey, Dr. T, I've got another rash on my unit. Do you mind having a look? And indeed, there's sort of this vesicular rash which makes us think of herpes. Now, this is not Dr. C's first brush with herpes. In fact, it's an illness he's come to know quite well. However, this time, it's associated with urethral discharge. Urethral discharge, so another key symptom. And indeed, he has some testicular pain as well as inguinal lymphadenopathy, or swollen lymph nodes in the inguinal chain. Furthermore, Dr. C complains of a sore throat as well as some oral ulcers and anal symptoms. So these are, remember, you know, with sort of progressive sexual practices, symptoms can present at different orifices, and a broad history is going to be important, especially for folks that are in sexual minority groups. So this is not the time to be shy, and it can be serious. You know, for example, condylomas in the anal region is a serious risk factor for anal cancer, and I've seen that. So now is not the time to be shy. Any other sort of important signs or history to elicit for a gentleman like Dr. C coming into your office?
Right. So one thing that we can discuss is, you know, what is Dr. C's understanding of STIs? Does he know what they are, how they're spread, and what high-risk behaviors are? Similarly, have they talked with their partner or partners or other gooners about STIs and whether their partners might have contracted something in the past? When did they get tested last? What kind of contraception are they using? You know, we really want to focus on, you know, barrier protection. Have they had previous STIs and have they had previous testing? You know, Dr. C might want to ask him when his last pap test was.
Anal pap is used in the MSM community. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Maybe asking more about some systemic symptoms like fever or lymphadenopathy, things like arthralgia as well. We want to keep our differential broad. You know, not everybody that's coming in is just going to have chlamydia and gonorrhea. If there's a lot of high-risk behavior, we want to assess for some of the more serious things as well.
Yeah. So that, and it's interesting, like things that you wouldn't even necessarily intuitively associate with a specific risk burden, such as active substance misuse, particularly stimulants like methamphetamine, should be elicited on history. And in fact, are used as part of qualifying questionnaires for HIV prophylactic medication like PrEP. So sort of interesting. Yeah, but like we itemized there, a number of partners, the gender, what orifices are used, if there's any comorbid substance use, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Now, yeah. Dr. C, I think you were telling us earlier about a certain acronym that we can use to remember at least five elements of the sexual history to include on an exam.
Penis, pussy. What else?
Prostate.
Prostate. Pustule.
Oh, well, the five P's are partners, so the number and the gender, as we mentioned. Practices, so vaginal, oral, you know, are they anal receptive, protection, pregnancy prevention, you know, what they're using for their for their barriers, and past history of STIs.
Dr. C, do you use a dental dam?
Dude, I said I'm abstinent.
When you're gooning, no?
No. No.
No. Okay, fair enough.
Because that's not sexual behavior.
Yeah, that would be funny if a patient identified gooning as one of his sexual behaviors. Okay, so why don't we then, shall we can jump into sort of specific presentations if you'd like. I'm not sure how you guys want to structure it.
Let's just jump right into it, into chlamydia, our most diagnosed and reported bacterial STI. Typically affects our younger population, or young men and young women in their early 20s. So like we said, some of the symptoms in men, well, typically or oftentimes in both men and women, there could be no symptoms at all. It could be completely asymptomatic. But with men, some things you might expect are urethral discharge, urethritis, some dysuria, urethral itch, conjunctivitis if it gets up there, testicular pain, and possibly proctitis as well. And in women, you might expect some cervicitis, some vaginal discharge, abnormal vaginal bleeding, lower abdominal pain, dysuria, dyspareunia, also conjunctivitis, and yeah.
Yeah, so sort of urethritis and both, and then, you know, vague sort of pelvic PID or pelvic inflammatory disease in women if they're going to be, if they're going to manifest symptoms. So generally speaking, men are going to be more symptomatic at presentation than our females. Another, I will just, and yet the, an entity that I've seen a few times, like you say, is swelling in the inguinal chain, which is lymphogranuloma venereum. So that is by definition chlamydia. So don't, if you have a young man who has lots of swollen inguinal lymph nodes, they don't necessarily, if for, for weeks or months, they don't necessarily have a lymphoma. They may very well just have some chlamydia. So that's kind of a fun fact. And it won't always come out in the urine test either. Okay, so presentation, we talked about epidemiology, most commonly diagnosed STI, especially young, among younger folks. It can persist, and it can hang out, if it's, especially if it's prostatitis, a proctitis, or this LGV entity. It can hang out for many, many weeks. But typically speaking, folks can remain, you know, symptomatic on the order of weeks, but tracing is actually 2 months. So it's reportable in our jurisdiction anyway, for 60 days, with the thought that, you know, within that window, you potentially can transmit it to someone else if you're not treated. All right. Now, what else do we want to say about that?
You mentioned some sort of swabs, so we can get into investigations. One of the tests for this, for chlamydia is a nucleic acid amplification test. So, you know, a swab, a urethral swab in women, and you could do another cervical swab, or a vaginal swab for, well, you could just stick with the endocervical swab for women as well. I was just thinking about vaginal swab for trichomonas as well with the wet mouth.
Yeah, and I think that's the exact point, is that practically speaking, it's the NAT test from urine, full stop. Urethral swabs are basically never done anymore. However, in terms of cervical or vaginal swab, there's some utility there because of the differential, right? And that's why, you know, talking a little bit about PID versus, so the, you know, a more generic presentation, because a lot, there's a lot of overlap in the symptom presentation, whether it's gonorrhea, chlamydia, trich, and others, bacterial vaginosis, candidiasis. So that's why, yes, you can rule out chlamydia and gonorrhea with a urine test, but there is a very common differential that would require a vaginal swab, for example. And vaginal swab, women can self-swab as well. So if you give them a viral and a charcoal swab, for a vaginal swab anyway, they just insert 3 centimeters, hold it there for 10 seconds, and you're on your way. With men, obviously, it's just a urine test. One little sort of interesting feature there is that it's not a... The instruction is to have held the bladder for at least 20 minutes. I normally tell patients an hour prior to providing urine sample. Because the, and it doesn't have to, it can be initial void. It doesn't have to be midstream because the gnat test is much more sensitive if it's been hanging around, the urine that is, has been hanging around, for at least 20 minutes, but if not an hour. And remember, folks with urethritis may be peeing very frequently, you know, every 5 minutes. So you need to instruct them. You got to hold on to it. It needs to be about 20 mils, and if there's no voiding in the previous hour, that's optimal.
And, you know, if we do find positive result with this urine, what are we thinking in terms of treatment here? My take is that you're most likely just going to co-treat chlamydia and gonorrhea at the same time. But the chlamydia would be specifically targeted with doxycycline or azithromycin. I think doxycycline would be preferred, 100 milligrams POBID for 7 days. But they do have side effects. So if there's concern about a compliance, then you could go with azithromycin, 1 gram PO, single dose for the azithromycin. And then we can get into the gonorrhea afterwards. Does that sound, are you guys?
Yeah, like that?
That's for short-term treatment. That sounds good. But long-term, I would also throw an abstinence on top of that. Permanent
abstinence.
Yes.
That's a good point.
This chastity being chased, returning to the church. But practically speaking, Dr. C, how long do you think one should abstain for, so as not to transmit it to your fellow gooners?
How long you should? I believe that everybody should be abstinent. I'm very trad.
That is extreme trad.
I believe that sex is purely for when you're trying to make a baby.
Yeah, I mean, but what if you're always trying to make a baby? But yeah, 7 days. So, you know, doxy treatment is 7 days. So wait until you're finished the course. And then if you're doing a one-time azithro, 1 gram, it should be 7 days of abstinence before, you know, that bacteria is eradicated. So that can be hard for some people. And then they end up passing it back and forth between partners. The other feature to consider there is just pregnancy implications. You'll often do a routine urine with these folks, a urine preg, that is, because doxycycline, well, technically both doxycycline and some other antibiotics are contraindicated in pregnancy. So just be aware of that. You can use azithro in pregnancy. I think it certainly comes up in different guidelines to co-treat. It was definitely commonly recommended to co-treat chlamydia if gonorrhea. So gonorrhea being far less common than is chlamydia. But the thing with the gnat test now is they're so sensitive that is like, I mean, I can't quote you specifically, but it's, you know, it's like 98% sensitivity if the urine is collected properly, that those guidelines, most recent guidelines are actually not to prophylactically co-treat, even for gonococcal infections. Apparently the CPS, that is the Canadian Pediatric Society, still recommends that. I don't know why that is. But anyhow, now that the gnat test is so good, formerly they were culturing, like, you know, growing on agar. But now that it's a nucleic acid test, it's so sensitive that you don't routinely have to co-treat. When you see these people in the eMERGE, though, I would say that I still see that not infrequently, especially with like teens that are presenting to the eMERGE. And I guess the assumption is that, you know, STIs are going to be more common in them, or they're going to be, you know, potentially non-adherent or something like that. But just in terms of antimicrobial stewardship, most guidelines have eliminated that prophylactic co-treatment. And then in terms of test of cure, any settings where we would potentially think about that? So people that are, yeah, go ahead.
Like if the risk of reinfection is high, I think the typical recommendation is in 6 months to repeat the testing.
Yeah. Sweet. Yeah. Routinely you can offer screening in 6 months. In pregnant folks, you can repeat it sort of 3 to 4 weeks. Okay. Sweet. And be aware that if you do it sooner than that, you can still get especially people that are anxious or have partners or like, oh, I want to be retested. I want to make sure that this has been eliminated. If you test them sooner than about 2 weeks, they can still be NAT positive. That is, there can still be, genetic material from chlamydia that's hanging out. But it doesn't mean that they have an active infection. So testing sooner than 2 weeks, especially, it can just be a waste of time after antibiotic.
And then if they don't come in, if they just allow themselves to discharge day in and day out and stay in their underwear, then the complications that could arise for men include things like urethral strictures, so they won't be busting the ropes in quite the volume as they would typically, epididymitis and infertility risk as well. And the more severe infections. And for women, PID, certainly a complication. And with that, infertility, ectopic pregnancies, chronic pelvic pain, and perinatal infection as well are complications.
Yeah. And like serious business too. That's why, taking this, for most men, it's like, whatever, you can shrug it off. But women with PID can really suffer. So getting these men and or getting these folks and treating them appropriately is huge. All right. So I think that was a good, outline of chlamydia treating. And then just remember, it depends on your jurisdiction. A lot of labs will forward a positive result to public health, and then they'll do all the tracing or work with the patient for all the tracing. But it may be different in your jurisdiction. For testing purposes, you might just say, ensure public health or report to public health. Sweet. Chlamydia, most common infection. We just dominated that. Now you know how to manage it.
Easy peasy. Let's move on to gonorrhea, our second most common infection. In terms of what we'll expect in terms of symptoms, about 70% of people are going to be asymptomatic, but otherwise the symptoms are going to be quite similar to our chlamydia presentation. So for men, again, urethritis, epididymitis, you could have a pharyngeal infection, proctitis and conjunctivitis as well. And there is also the risk of disseminated gonococcal infection. And then again, for women, cervicitis, pelvic inflammatory disease, urethritis, perihepatitis, conjunctivitis, proctitis, just all sorts of itises and inflammation as a result of this infection as well. And these symptoms, they'll typically appear about 2 to 6 weeks after the infection, similar to the chlamydia.
It's kind of a weird thing to think about, but like how the GU tract in women is continuous with the abdomen. You know what I mean? Like if you bust, those bacteria can ascend up the uterus and out the fallopian tubes into the peritoneum, which is messed up to think about. That's why you get these sort of intra-abdominal infections, especially, you mentioned perihepatic infection, and that can cause like these webs, web-like adhesions. You can like bust into the abdomen, technically.
That sounds really gross to me, and I don't know what woman would ever put up with that.
Yeah, so there's that. There's absolutely that. How is this diagnosed? I think the gnat is still super sensitive.
It is.
I know that. Yeah, I think we still culture because there's growing antibiotic resistance. Dr. C, do you ever swab yourself?
Never, dude. I'm abstinent.
Yeah, but after those gooning sessions, like, how do you like clean the mice? Do you clean the keyboards and stuff before you join the gooning session, or what's your approach?
Not really. I feel like my area down there is pretty. I feel pretty self-cleaning.
And during the COVID pandemic, is there at least 6 feet between the computer stations? And are you guys in masks, or how does that normally work?
No, we're any mask, so we don't wear them. We also are not within 6 feet, or we are within 6 feet. Sorry, because breaking the 6 foot rule and being any mask kind of go hand in hand.
Are there any like devices, for example, like, I don't know, whether it's flashlights or anything like that, that are reused in the gooning caves, or not so much?
We do reuse dildos.
Very good. And I think that is actually a good opportunity to highlight that toys, whether it's again with queer folk, that toys are a nidus of infection. So it's something to be aware of, especially with lesbian couples. So lesbian couples will have reasonably high prevalence of things like chlamydia. So it's not just highlighting that really important point that it's not just penile, anal, or vaginal penetration that's a risk factor here. So I think that was a useful sort of anecdote to highlight that important population. So thank you for that, Dr. C. So in terms of management of gonorrheal infection, like we said, there is risk of antibiotic resistance, so getting a culture can be useful. The culture is not, so if they're NAT positive, they have it. If they're culture negative, you might want to consider reculturing.
I guess part of why I was pushing for the cultures is to test for that antimicrobial susceptibility specifically. So,
right.
NAT is fine. It's highly sensitive and specific.
Right. And so the dosing is still, and this is what's kind of confusing, you still use azithro regardless, right? Like it's not necessarily just about prophylaxis against chlamydia as well. So you use azithro and practically speaking, cefixime, but you can also use ceftriaxone. So if you're worried and you want a little bit of a higher dose, you can call them into clinic and give them an IM injection of ceftriaxone, but oral cefixime. And that is a one-time dose, 800 milligram oral cefixime, and then oral azithromycin is sufficient. And if there's a cephalosporin or penicillin, they're anxious about it, allergy, 2 grams, a one-time 2 gram dose of azithromycin can be sufficient as well. So that's good. And any other comments around management? Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, the test of cure 3 to 4 weeks after the treatment is completed. And again, similar to the chlamydia, if the risk of reinfection is high, you can do a repeat test in about 6 months as well.
Sweet. And again, it's reportable.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's good. Chlamydia and gonorrhea. Very, very common presentation. You're going to see it all the time, if not in your own genitals. And now you know how to manage it.
Gross.
Dr. C, do you have any active infections that you were hoping to get a bit of guidance around?
Yeah, crabs.
Okay. Yeah, we can talk about crabs briefly.
I have a little, little family of crabs down there.
Just running horizontally.
Of crustaceans.
Okay, so pubic lice and scabies most common. They'll be, you know, super, super itchy is the prominent feature there. If it's, you know, exclusively pubic lice, it will be isolated to the groins. If it's scabies, it's probably going to be disseminated, but a lot of people will have it worst in the pelvic area, which, and again, it doesn't mean it's an STI. But looking for those, you know, burrows, and especially in web spaces or intertriginal spaces, that is sort of where your thigh meets the groin, looking for those burrows and tracking marks. So in terms of management, wash all the clothes, wash all the bedding, high heat. You want to vacuum the shit out of your mattress. Some people will just leave their clothing for 2 weeks. Clothing and bedding for 2 weeks if possible. And then you want to do a head to toe treatment with high dose Nix cream or permethrin cream, so the 5%, as opposed to the lower 1% that's used for normal lice. So you want the high dose. And then very rarely, I think it's Norwegian scabies. This is a fun fact that comes up during COVID, where oral ivermectin can be used. But normally that Nix cream, head to toe, left on overnight is sufficient to eradicate it, which is nice. Like, how fortunate are we, hey, to have effective treatments like that? So that's what you'll want to do, Dr. C. So that's a good discussion of lice. Why don't we then move on to a couple of other really high yield ones? I think HPV we can treat or discuss separately, you know, especially in a discussion of cervicitis and perhaps cervical cancer. But HSV, do you guys want to chat about that for a minute, because it's so common?
Yeah. Dr. C, how's the HSV looking now? We were examining earlier for a bit of urethritis, and some genital pain. Now, were you having any other symptoms at the time?
Yeah, lesions.
Lesions, genital lesions.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And I have lots of lesions.
Right, and where are they located?
Like around, like you know the area that's like between your scrotum and your asshole.
Right, the taint.
The taint.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All that. Tainted in love.
Ooh. My taint is just covered with lesions.
Are you having fevers as well? I mean, that sounds very serious. Are you having fevers?
Oh, yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah. You know, oftentimes when things are looking that severe, you might, some patients might notice tender lymphadenopathy. I don't know how long this has been going on. Is this a first episode, or is this a recurrent episode for you?
Oh, yeah. No, this is congenital.
That's congenital. Okay. So
not uncommon, though, surprisingly. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, one thing to keep in mind: first episodes, they tend to be especially bad. That's when you get all those lesions. But recurrent episodes, typically, they're not as severe, and it may be a shorter duration of the flare as opposed to the first time it kind of comes around. And then
meningitis, that, just to add, and I think you outlined all of those, you know, the vesicles, systemic symptoms like headache, fever, etc., lymphadenopathy, but meningitis is not uncommon with the first, with the primary infection, like 10%, which is kind of crazy. And it's a very, very common cause of viral meningitis. Anyway, sorry.
Right.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah. And you can get herpes simplex encephalitis as well. It is the most common type of vocal encephalitis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, primarily affecting like frontal and temporal lobes, and results in all sorts of wild issues like gustatory hallucinations and personality changes and even some psychotic behaviors. So things can go really awry in the brain with herpes simplex.
Ah, interesting. Okay. So that was sort of primary. And then you talked about how recurrence tends to be less severe.
Yeah. Systemic symptoms are a lot less likely with recurrent disease. There might be kind of grumblings before the actual event as well. Some prodromal symptoms, if you will. And typically I would say in the initial episodes, at least my ulcers, they last about 15 days, whereas on the subsequent episodes, they last about 10 days.
Yeah, and exactly. And like I think the prodromal symptoms are so important to highlight because that's relevant to treatment. So people will often talk about like the vague tingling sensation. And the thing is the antivirals are so safe taking those, you know, that vague sort of tingling or burning sensation seriously, I think is important. So again, focal burning, itching, vague tingling, will likely predict, an outbreak, and, intervening early is when the medications are effective. So taking that seriously, I think is important.
Yeah. And some things that can bring on the prodromal symptoms as well as the recurrent episode itself do include things like stress. So kind of like the psychosocial stuff, flu, menstrual cycles, when the body is stressed out, then you can have a bit of a breakout.
Pointing out that over 50% of transmission is well asymptomatic. So routine use of condoms is recommended. Obviously, if there's an outbreak, you're super contagious. But for most couples, most couples do get it well asymptomatic. Risk reduction if you have a serodiscordant couple, that is one has it, the other doesn't, you can offer viral load reducing daily, for example, Valtrex, which can reduce the risk of transmitting to the other partner, but condoms are optimal. So that's sort of HSV in terms of presentation and some fun facts. In terms of management, any specific thoughts there?
Well, first off, you're going to have to sit them down and break the bad news that HSV is not curable. Mm-hmm. So all of our treatment is going to be basically to suppress any current episode and future episodes. So you will want to be chatting with them about avoiding, genital-to-genital contact, genital-oral contact with active lesions. So nobody lick Dr. C's taint, at least until we get him on some Valtrex. Try to use condoms in the meantime. We can have, as we mentioned, that daily suppressive antiviral therapy. I remember reading that study, the Valtrex study on couples, yeah, it's effective, but I got the impression that it's merely a matter of time, you know, even yeah. with the Valtrex, with the condoms, you know, eventually it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I think the risk reduction is again like 50%. So, but I mean, if you're with someone where there's serodiscordance for years, yeah, then it's like, well, 50% is fine, but it's still basically an inevitability. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, what meds we can offer, if it's a first episode, then we go for the antivirals. So acyclovir, for example, 200 milligrams PO 5 times daily for 5 to 10 days. Famciclovir, 250 milligrams for 5 days, or valacyclovir, 1,000 milligrams PO BID for 10 days. That'll be the first approach, or first episode. If it's a severe first episode, we can go like IV acyclovir, and, infusion with oral therapy once there is, improvement in the symptoms. If it's a recurrent episode, then we can consider valacyclovir, at a lower dose, 500 milligrams PO BID or a gram daily, once daily for 3 days. And then we can consider famciclovir and acyclovir for that as well at lower doses. And if we want to do a more of a suppressive dose where maybe if the occurrences are happening at least every couple months, then... Or in pregnancy, I guess, in the last couple of months before, in the last couple of months of pregnancy, then we can consider acyclovir again, 200 milligrams PO, TID to 5 times daily, or famciclovir, 250 milligrams BID, or valacyclovir, 500 milligrams PO daily.
I think it's used a little bit higher in pregnancy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, like you said, 500 daily for most people. And it's such a safe, medication that like I have such a low threshold. If anyone is complaining about any sort of vague tingling and they want it, I just put a bunch of refills on it. Very, very safe, medication. And you know, obviously it's a social issue, and if you take it as soon as you have those prodromal symptoms, you get the best response. And in fact, after your manifesting vesicles, the effectiveness is really decreased, like at 72 days. At 72 hours. So I think that was really good. I'm just sort of mindful of time here. Do you want to? Because we're at sort of an hour. Do you want to kind of wrap up for this session of STIs? There are kind of specific entities that probably deserve, a longer treatment, such as HIV. Do you want to start to sort of wrap up that? I think a really useful outline of the most common STIs, that is chlamydia, gonorrhea, and HSV.
Oh yeah, I think that's more than enough. You know, you can tune in to our future episodes. I'm sure we will cover it sometime soon. But yeah, we will discuss some of the more rarer but still relevant diseases that you see all the time: HIV, syphilis, and our HPV is the one that we missed today. We can also reassess
Dr. C's symptoms at that time, you know, whether in fact this is an HSV and crabs outbreak or something perhaps more sinister. We'll definitely touch base around that after some further investigations and testing. Dr. C, do you have anything to add in closing?
My lesions are starting to rupture, so I'm going to have to... I'm
going
to have to get out of here
to prepare
that.
To soft this.
Yeah. Perfect. This happens every night around 9 p.m.
Oh, my God.
9 p.m.
Dude, it sucks.